HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 134, recorded live Wednesday, October 8th, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RED Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Jeff Atwood, Jeff Dalgas, and Jared Dixon from StackOverflow.com.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I have the pleasure to sit down today with Jeff Atwood, Jeff Dalgas, and Jared Dixon from the currently epic and rising StackOverflow.com. Thanks, guys, for taking the time to chat with me today.
Sure. Hey, you're welcome.
Our pleasure.
So how's it going, Stack Overflow? Has it gotten as big and wonderful as you thought it would?
I think we're still recovering from the idea that it's actually working. Like, it hasn't fallen over. Because we did, like, get Slashdotted, although Slashdot isn't quite the monster they used to be.
Isn't that funny? I got Slashdotted twice last month, and both times didn't notice it. Not only because I don't read Slashdot, but because it didn't really change the traffic on my site very much.
Right. Yeah, it's not quite the monster it used to be, but there was a lot of traffic on that first day. In fact, that first day is still a peak we haven't gotten back to. So it's sort of like...
Really?
No, it's like a mountain. Well, because there's just so much publicity around the first day. But we're slowly inching up, but it's just there was a lot of traffic. So if we were going to fall over, we would have definitely fallen over on the first day. And I think I'm just impressed that we didn't, frankly.
That's awesome. So let's back up, and for those who haven't gone to StackOverflow.com, what's the concept?
So the concept of Stack Overflow is something that me and Joel Spolsky, sort of a joint venture that we put together, and it's based on really a couple things. One of the largest reasons we went after this was we felt like there's this site whose name rhymes with Expert Sex Change that we think is kind of a little bit evil in the way that they approach the world, yeah. In that they're letting people ask and answer these questions, but they have this sort of slimy way that they present the information, and you feel like they're trying to trick you every time you go there, and it just feels very much like used car salesmen.
You Google for stuff, you find them as the answer, and you can see part of the answer in the Google index. Then you click, and then they lie, and they say, pay us.
Right. Well, you can actually scroll down. That's the trick of that site, is if you scroll all the way down, then the information is, in fact, there. And there are some, although we're also finding that that particular site tends to be a little bit more IT-focused. There are some programming questions there, and you will get hits. Like, I do get organic hits on them. And it's the sort of thing, whenever you see the links in the result, you sort of groan to yourself. You're like, oh, great, right? You know, there might be something there, but clicking on it just is an exercise in futility most of the time. It makes you sort of hate yourself when you go there. And we kind of wanted a site like that for programmers, where when you go there, you didn't hate yourself, and maybe you actually even enjoyed going there. And the other thing driving it is I feel like there's a lot of really talented programmers who don't blog, and they don't really have an online presence, like, say, Scott, you and I do, you know, where we talk about we're noisy, right? We're very noisy. But a lot of programmers are very quiet, and yet they have, you know, really great information, and we want to sort of unlock that and make it really easy for them to come in and participate and, you know, ask and answer questions in an extremely low-friction way. And by that, I mean, you don't even have to log in. So it's a little bit like Wikipedia in that regard.
Uh-huh. You're trying to create the developer's third place.
Maybe.
You know about the theory of the third place, right?
Sure,
you know, sure. Home, work, and then either church or bar. This is their third place.
Well, I sort of got tired of telling people to blog, too. It was like, okay, you should just start a blog. And you realize eventually that, although that has worked really well for you and I and a bunch of other people, it's really not just something everybody's going to pick up. It's not really something that's in everybody's DNA to actually go out and start a blog and keep writing every week or every day. But there's other ways they can participate. And Stack Overflow is kind of like that. I really do view Stack Overflow as my coding horror 2.0. It's like coding horror where instead of being a commenter on my post, you can own it. Right, you can go in and ask a question that you own. It's like your little blog post, And it can be maintained. You know, it has aspects of Wikipedia. It has aspects of, you know, voting systems like Dig and Reddit, where you can vote things up and down. You know, we're trying to synthesize all these things together. And it's sort of the end result of my experience online of sort of a place I would like to participate in, right? Where I'm just a peer. I'm not like the guy who owns it. You're on my blog. It's like something we collaboratively build together. So that was sort of the vision.
Well, it's like a community garden.
Yeah.
I mean, I've noticed that there's not a lot of chuff around the site. I mean, people are tending to their questions. And I like that there are 1,000 different ways to find the same information. And it's all where you think it would be. You click on your name, it goes to your profile, you go down, it says, oh, here's all the questions that you've ever asked. You go to see what you've ever voted on. I mean, you're tracking everything.
Right.
You throw nothing away.
Right. No,
and
that's right.
You throw nothing away because it's all valuable.
Right. This is a programmer's site. I mean, we built it like, you know, programmers love data, right? Programmers love nothing more than going to like Task Manager. And I have this sort of running joke of, what do programmers do when they encounter a new program? They go to the options dialog and they see what's available. That's like the first thing I do. It's like, oh, I want to go to the options dialog. That's how I judge a program. Like when I installed Chrome, I was just blown away by the fact that my browser had like a task manager. I was so sold, you know, the minute I saw that, I was like, oh my God, a task manager. They totally get it, right? And Stack Overflow is a site for programmers. So we have lots and lots of metrics and like ways you can drill down into the data because that's fun for programmers, right? I mean, we love that crap. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. So it's very much for a specific audience. One way we wanted to avoid sort of the Yahoo Answers problem, and we did a lot of research on related Q&A sites before we started this, and one pitfall we found with sites like this is the more broad you go in audience, the worse it gets. So we're trying to stay very laser-focused to software developers. We're not trying to meet everyone's needs in the world, like all the IT people, mm-hmm. you know, internal wikis, things like that. We're just trying to meet the average programmer's needs with this site and stay focused on that audience.
Don't you think it's getting a little sloppy on the homepage, though, because you've got Ruby guys next to Perl guys next to mainframe programmers, and I don't want to answer those questions. I don't want to read those questions. I want a homepage that's customized.
Well, we are working on customization, and I think that's becoming an increasing issue now that the site's, you know, getting more and more people attracted to it. But honestly, part of it, I think, is a little bit of an attraction. One of the things I liked about my blog, Coding Horror, is that it tends to attract people that program in a variety of different things. It's not necessarily like a Microsoft-centric site. It's like, I'm a Microsoft developer. Here's my Microsoft tools. But it attracted people from really all walks of life in programming. And I loved that aspect of it. And there's a little bit of that we're really shooting for in Stack Overflow, where we're trying to avoid sort of being the ghetto of like, oh, this is the SQL Server ghetto, or this is the, you know, C-sharp ghetto, where we just do C-sharp, and if you post a VB question, we're going to make fun of you. Or it's not, you know, the correct language. So I think part of it is really rubbing shoulders with programmers from other walks of life, you know? Not totally, because obviously I can't answer Perl questions. I don't really know.
Well, you know, that's
Perl.
Interesting. How about, here's a thought. You know, I could see you getting the ghettoization of Stack Overflow if you simply let me as a user come on and say, I only want to see ASP.NET stuff. Meh.
Right.
And then, but if you had an option, if you had a slider bar that let me select how much leakage I wanted, leakage is probably not the best user interface word, but you know what I'm saying?
Right.
I want only ASP.NET, but I'll have 10% leakage. So let other stuff randomly leak into my homepage.
Right.
That would be cool.
Right. No, definitely customization is sort of the great undiscovered country for us. And we're getting deeply into it now because we realize that, and particularly with regards to answering questions, like it's fun for me to browse these questions and read them sometimes. And it's surprising how people would just come up with really interesting topics across a variety of different languages that are intriguing. Like it's kind of just fun to read what people are posting on some level. But in terms of actually answering stuff, like I said, I don't know Perl. So if you have a Perl question, I mean, I may read it. It might be fun, but I'm not going to be able to answer it. So in terms of showing unanswered questions, that's the first area we're going to get into really hardcore customization, where we're going to try to show you only things that you have a track record of participating in, right? Like if you've posted 50 answers to ASP.NET questions, then, well, that's what we're going to show you. We're going to show you things dealing with ASP.NET in terms of unanswered. And then that's going to start bleeding over into other areas of the site from the unanswered page. In fact, that's something that Jeff is working on at the moment.
It's going to be really interesting to see what the longevity is, whether, I mean, because, you know, with games, like this, and games like Guild Wars, there's the initial excitement, the frantic leveling up, and then the plateauing, and then the depression. How to push this past that level? You know, I mean, I'm a level 70. I've got all the gold badges.
Right.
Then how do you keep them interested? And the way you keep them interested is it has to leak into their life. And there I am with leakage again. It has to leak into their life as they're on Google and they start searching for it. And when you start showing up as some large percentage of answers, then it gets interesting. And then Stack Overflow really it sneaks into their lives from other directions.
Right. Well, one thing I found in participating in sort of online forums was that those were very much a game anyway. I mean, there was no levels, there was no score. But I realized that at some level, almost everything you do online is kind of like a game. I mean, maybe this is just a larger metaphor for life. But there's some aspect of it where you're playing this game, right? And we're just making that a little more explicit. And to be clear, everything that's in Stack Overflow that's, you know, game-like in terms of reputation scores and badges and things like that are really there to drive good behavior, right? They're not in there in an arbitrary way where we say, okay, we're just going to give you points and you're going to earn points. You get points. Here's an example. So how do you actually get reputation? It's very much like Google's PageRank system in that you don't get reputation yourself. Other people give it to you. That's the only way to get reputation in our system with very, very minor exceptions. So for you to get reputation, other people have to like your stuff. It has to be validated by other people, right? Whereas in a traditional, you know, multiplayer game like World of Warcraft, you can get you can level up by just killing, you know, random things on the site, right? Mm-hmm. You could just sit there and kill rats for days and days and days, and there's a point of diminishing return, but eventually you will level up. On our site, you know, you can't really kill, like, wharf rats or whatever. Other people have to like what you're doing and click up on it to actually give you reputation. So it's sort of very much a positive feedback loop driven by, you know, the community, the other people liking what you're posting and finding it helpful and interesting and useful. So we hope it is game-like, but I do want to be clear that, you know, the reputation comes from other people, and ultimately what we're trying to do is you know, go stand shoulder to shoulder with your peers and post cool and interesting things that they react positively to.
Cool. Well, let's take the conversation into a more technical direction and see if we can hear from Jeff and Jared. So how long did it take you to build this, and what did you build it in? Maybe one of the guys could share the laundry list of technologies.
Yeah, in fact, I think Jared should take that, because Jared did so much really great work initially getting the project up and running. So, Jared, did you want to talk about just starting out and how we did it?
Sure. Whenever you came to me, you said, hey, why don't we try this new MVC, ASP.NET MVC framework? You know, it was like the first preview was out, and, you know, I'd been working on doing a lot with Ruby on Rails just personally, and I really wanted to, you know, use an MVC framework. So we started out going with that direction, and after using web forms for 6-7 years, I really wanted to change, and it's like a breath of fresh air working with the ASP.NET MVC framework. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of designed the front end with that, and the back end we used SQL Server 2005. And that was nice to use. I've been using Oracle for so long. So I guess it took us about 3-4 months to code most of the site. So, and, you know, working with the different preview releases, that's been a real good challenge.
And how did you conceive, I mean, when you conceived of this, was this all, I mean, how did the design process go? Was it, did you visualize this in your head and then draw it on a napkin, and then you got a designer? Is one of you three a designer?
No. Design was one of the big challenges. So Joel and I sort of had ideas. You know, Joel, I think, had his .NET discussion group, his Joel and Software discussion boards, which occasionally I'll get organic hits to those as well when I'm searching for something on Google. So I was aware of those. I wasn't really participating in them. But they're extremely bare bones, like by design. And Joel has a whole post about that. But Joel and I had some really clear thoughts about, like, how you build a community and sort of the ways you combine these features together to make it interesting and useful. So I think that was a lot of the initial design, was Joel and I just were going back and forth. And then Jared and I did a ton of research. We spent a week just going to, like, every Q&A site on the internet, like, almost literally. Jared, do you want to talk a little bit about that phase?
Yeah, whenever we would send each other links, you know, to some of the hilarious questions. You know, Jeff had mentioned earlier, you know, he had to keep a laser-like focus on, you know, software developers because, like, for instance, Yahoo Answers, like, people were asking crazy questions like, how is a babby formed? You know, it's just...
It's really amazing. Yahoo Answers is just disturbing how weird it gets so rapidly. And because the topics are so broad, you can ask literally anything. And when you can ask anything, it's just sort of craziness ensues. And the example I like to use is YouTube, where if you have a really popular YouTube video, the comments are going to be just crap, right? But here's the thing. If you find a YouTube video that's really narrow, you'll actually find some really useful comments there. It's surprising. There's this, there's like two classes of usage around YouTube. One is sort of the generic, you know, look at a woman, a scantily clad woman dancing video. And then there's like these super narrow videos that only maybe 10,000 people in the world care about. And those have really good comments. And our thought was, hey, let's have a world of incredibly narrow technical problems that only 100,000, 2,000 people in the world would care about. And that's sort of how you get the signal-to-noise ratio up, is because the signal is so narrow. That was sort of the thing we found there. And it's amazing how many of these sites there are. There's like AnswerBag, WikiAnswers. Jared and I were finding all these sites. We had no idea.
Really? I've never heard of these sites.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I've never heard of these sites. Are these just really boutique-type things?
No. I think they position themselves as, you know, the world's interface for asking questions. And, you know, a lot of them have a pretty large community. And we agree. We were surprised. We had never heard of many of these sites. But we were trying to just get ideas about, you know, how do you run a Q&A site? And how are people currently doing it, and sort of the things they're running into. So, you know, that was a good research phase, and that lasted, I would say, a week to 2 weeks. And, you know, the rest of it was just taking our collective experience. Certainly we've been to, like, the MSDN forums and, you know, other sort of programming hangouts that there are.
Sure. One of the things that's really just strikes me, and maybe it's just me, about the site was that somebody made a conscious decision to use alt text for everything so that I hover over virtually any element on the screen, and I get a little tooltip.
Right.
That just seems really both obvious, but also really clever, because it gives you extra information anytime you pause and go, "What? Oh, that's what that is," because the tooltip just pops up. Was that some dogma that came from on high?
That really came out of the feedback. So one thing I did early on was I emailed everybody I could think of that I sort of respected in terms of they had built sites like this, right? Or they had done things on the internet that were really impressive, that they had sort of created a site doing something that I liked. And I said, you know, please take a look at this. And I said, email me directly. And I took that feedback extremely seriously, because these are people that sort of have a track record of building things on the internet, which I really don't. I mean, I have my blog and stuff, but I haven't really built a site and put it out there. And one of the key pieces of feedback I got back was, you know, use tons of tooltip text. And I really took that to heart, and I tried to do it in tons of places throughout the site. So really, a lot of what we do is really driven by feedback, not everything, but certainly we try to sort of fold in all the good ideas that we're getting from people and also that we see on other sites on the internet.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman with a word from our sponsor. Do you know how to build Web 2.0 AJAX applications with Web 1.0 components? You really can't. If you want to do the next generation web applications, you'll need next generation components, just like the ones that our friends at Telerik have got. They're RAD controls for ASP.NET AJAX. It's a huge pack of web controls built on top of ASP.NET AJAX that'll add previously impossible performance and interactivity to your next project. The new controls mirror the AJAX API from ASP.NET, so development is really straightforward. The client scripts are shared, so loading time is not a problem. You just set a couple of properties and you'll be able to automatically bind to web services for a really efficient operation. The new RAD editor from ASP.NET AJAX Telerik loads up to 4 times faster than before, and the new RAD grid handles thousands of records in just milliseconds. But as always, it's best to try for yourself. So you can visit telerik.com/ASP.NET AJAX and download a trial. Thanks a lot. Now I'm looking at the homepage here and I'm seeing recent questions, recent tags, recent badges, and then within each question you've got how long ago it happened, who did it, then statistics on that particular individual, what does the shape of the data look like on the homepage? How many queries are happening here? Are there a dozen little queries or one epic query with a lot of, you know, what's the shape of this data?
We're doing a lot of queries. We're using Link to SQL as our underlying sort of DAO, I guess you'd say. I tend to lean heavily towards the database as model camp. I know this is heresy to a lot of people, but...
Oh, yeah. So as well as not learning C.
Yeah, exactly. Not learning C. But Link to SQL is nice in that regard because it's very lightweight. It's essentially almost like having raw SQL in your application. And in a lot of places, we do still have raw SQL in our app because I'm a little bit old school about that. But I love Link. I want to be clear. Link is
really
super
cool. Really? You're saying that you break the fourth wall and you just go right down and you pull out ADO.net in some spots?
Well, we use the Link context. So db.execute command, which is a link, mm-hmm. you know, the accepted link way of
having. Yeah, but underneath it's still going to go in. It's going right to the database.
Yeah. Yeah, in some places we are. But in general, we're going through Link, so there's very little difference. So the homepage, for example, we're doing some grouping queries, but we also found that the way MVC works, it can be a little bit of a challenge to figure out sort of where the data access is occurring, because you'll build a model, you know, model view controller, and your model will have some property that makes it go get more data. And it can be kind of subtle mm-hmm. sometimes about when you have a view accessing one of these properties on the model, and then that triggers a whole bunch of queries. So then effectively your view is querying the database if you really think about what's happening, which, you know, depending on how dogmatic you want to be about MVC, you're not really supposed to do that. The views are supposed to be really dumb and just, you know, dump data on the page in a specific format.
Yeah.
But it can be subtle to figure out, okay, if I access this property, bam, 50 queries occur, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Jeff, did you want to talk about some of the optimization we did around? Because I think caching was our biggest challenge, honestly, with MVC. Because I think what we ran into was you have controllers. We kind of wanted sub-controllers because we wanted a way to sort of break up the data so that we could actually cache sort of sub-elements of the page, but not the whole page. So, Jeff, did you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah. I guess I'm a little embarrassed about our implementation of it as well.
Well, don't feel embarrassed because this is not, you're not, it's not like you're on stage trying to be a purist and justify your design. Because
I guess
ultimately you guys need to remember that success is ultimately the best metric.
Yeah, very good
right.
point.
And you guys are doing a good job, right? And you balanced pragmatism with purity. So it may not be academically correct, but let's talk about it in a frank way that without feeling that you're being judged, and then
okay.
after you open your soul to me and I, then I'll judge you. But until then.
So we're using some of the MVC contribs to get basically our views called back into our controllers in order to leverage caching. Because
we'll call back into it via what? You pass from your controller to your view, you pass a view model.
Right. There's a method called render action that allows, and I think it's
right.
gone in the latest version 5 of the MVC framework. So actually had to find it in the contribs where I'm using render action to call back into the home controller to basically have the view populate all its data. And by doing that,
okay.
I am then able to use the values that come back from the HTML to cache that. And we're able to, cache regions of the page instead of just the entire page because we did
now,
need that ability.
Is the caching done as an action filter on the controller?
We are using the. Let us see here. Yeah, we are using the action filters for the caching to occur, but we didn't want to cache like the entire home page for X number of seconds. We needed the ability to cache, let's say if you're looking at the recent tags on the home page, we wanted the recent tags section of the page to be cached for 5 minutes or for an X interval, but we wanted the rest of the page to be able to refresh over
sure.
1 minute intervals. So we have a global a view that shows just the default page, and then that view calls back into the controllers to get the information that's cached on different intervals, if that makes sense.
Right. Okay. So then the home controller has a recent tags thing that has an attribute on it that describes, you know, attribute, output cache,
right.
Parent, 5 minutes.
That's right.
So you're caching them at the render action level.
Right.
Okay. Are you running all this on, how many boxes do you have?
In this case, we just have one server that's acting as both our database and web server. And we run pretty hot. Usually, we're running about 40 to 50% CPU at times, and that's kind of during our really heavy loads. Okay.
What kind of box is this?
It's a quad-core, I believe it's Xeon. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, actually, it's a 8-core.
It's
dual quad. So we have 4 gigabytes of memory and then 8 real CPUs in there through two physical processors, 8 CPUs.
Right. Yeah, so it
You're running 40% on average on hot, when you're running hot on all 8 cores.
Right.
Well, 40% is cumulative. So that would mean we're doing 40% load.
And what's your memory pressure like with only 4 gigs?
It varies. I mean, we've improved our querying. I mean, one thing we found, I know it's sort of a running joke in computer science, but like all your performance is in the database. I mean, it's just ridiculous how much everything you do is determined by how fast you get data out of the database. And that's why also the caching turned out to be obviously super critical for us. I think there were a couple, so I want to talk about just a couple issues that we had during development. And one was the current version of MVC is not very cache friendly because it doesn't really let you break up controllers into sub-controllers. Because really, as Jeff was describing, you have a page that's really a bunch of sub-items, even though it's one controller action, and you want to cache different parts of that controller differently. So you really want to compose mm-hmm. your controllers into sub-controllers, and then each sub-controller would have a view associated with it that would have its own, you know, caching rules and stuff. So that was right. a little bit of a challenge, because for a site of our scale, we have to cache like crazy. Otherwise, we just fall over, right? We can't do hundreds of queries for every user like every second that they hit the page. That's just like mm-hmm. web design 101. And then beyond that, beyond the caching issue with MVC, I was really actually very disappointed in the way SQL Server works out of the box, SQL Server 2005. We had huge issues around deadlocks with what I feel like is not an unusual query load for a website, e.g. 98% reads and 2% writes, is that we were regularly blocking and deadlocking, like multiple times per hour. And it turns out, and I had a blog post about this, but I'm still kind of disappointed that they, out of the box, made this decision that we had to switch to this read committed view, or mm-hmm. this transaction level, which gives you, it's not like no lock. No lock is read uncommitted. I know you know about that because you've blogged about that before. But this is one level up from that. And once we switched to that, it's been totally smooth sailing. But until we did that,
did you feel
like pulling our hair out.
There was a little bit of backlash against that post. This is a tough question since we're such wonderful friends. But there were some people who said that post showed that you really didn't understand the issue around deadlocking. Do you disagree?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that don't actually read the entirety of what I write. Like, they read like a couple paragraphs and assume that, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But they don't sort of read the end. Because I think reading that post, if you actually read everything I wrote and get to the end of it, I'm just painting the entire picture of, you know, here's the problem.
Right.
Here's one thing you could do, right? And then here's, you know, actually what you should do, right? And in the what you could do was no lock, right? We talked about that because, and honestly, I've talked to people that have worked with DBAs that just tell people, it's like, yeah, use no lock on everything. It's like uh-huh. take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. There are DBAs out there who do this. And I think just because they've learned that unless you don't, you have locking problems. And for a lot of queries, does it really matter, right? Like, say I'm pulling back a user profile. Does it really matter if the profile is a little bit out of date at the time that I get it? I'm not sure that it does.
Right. Yeah. And this is, yeah. And you're saying, I'm hearing you say that you wish SQL Server had more of a realistic awareness of how the world typically works and had typical defaults, is what you're saying.
Well, it turns out that this read committed transaction level. Mm-hmm. I think it's the default in like Oracle and stuff. And people had left comments on my blog. They're like, wow, that's not the default. They were really shocked that this was not the default. And I think we were too, because I do not view our query load as unusual, certainly not for a website. So out of the box, SQL Server is just really ill-configured to build a website. I mean, that's really the bottom line. That was the point of that post, saying, hey, look, out of the box, SQL Server needs to be adjusted to work with sort of typical website loads. And once you do that, it's great. I mean, we haven't had any problems since then.
It'd be nice if there was a profile option. Like, you could tell SQL Server, here's how I intend to use you. Set yourself up appropriately.
Well, right. And I have sort of a heretical view on this anyway, that I think the database should be figuring out a lot of stuff. Like, you should index this column. Like, I think the database should be doing a lot of stuff. That
yeah, that's just kooky talk.
Automatically.
Yeah. I mean, it does learn a lot. I mean, SQL Server, and particularly SQL Server 2008, got really, really smart on query plans, which interestingly, I've said a few heretical things that have gotten me in trouble. Like, I believe that the day of the stored procedure is probably over.
Oh, I totally. I've been saying that for years.
Yeah. Okay. You're a progressive heretic.
I am totally.
You're ahead of your
time. Jeff Dalgas was telling me that Rob Connery added an Atwood method to Subsonic that actually accepts raw SQL.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly that was mentioned on one of the Hansel Minutes podcasts.
Yeah, he and I talked about that last week.
I just want to mention that I do have an affinity. I kind of like SQL. I will say that. I know Rob Connery kind of hates it, but I love it. Like, I think it's like, that to me is database assembly language, because the database is so important to your performance. I mean, it's like the thing that determines your performance. So if you don't have like a real lock on how you build SQL and like the performance characteristics of the SQL you're building, I mean, you're just really dead in the water. You're going to build an app that's going to be incredibly slow. So I view it as incredibly mission critical to deeply understand the actual SQL that you're emitting. And I don't really like the sort of Link does this very well, to be clear. Link doesn't. Outstanding job at this, but I want to see exactly what SQL is being generated and understand exactly why it's performing the way it's performing. Because when you look at Stack Overflow, it's 98% database junk.
It's fast. I mean, it is exquisitely fast. And I thought it was pretty cool when Obi Fernandez came on and asked if it was written in Rails. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was a great question.
Let me push back on one thing though, because I'm hearing that you're a pragmatist and you're a pure pragmatist. You know, make it work, do it right, get out of my way, let's go. But I'm shocked that you have your SQL Server running on the same machine as your web server.
Well, this gives us a really obvious upgrade path, right? I mean, this is one way of looking at this, is that we can...
But to go live with a SQL Server on, it's not behind a firewall, it's not in its own, you know, it needs to be out of the DMZ and behind a second firewall. I mean, I worked in finance for years, so maybe I'm just paranoid, but that's just the surface area for attack just doubled.
Well, it's behind, you know, the Windows firewall and stuff, and there's really no way to get to it unless you can remote desktop in like we do.
See, now you've just sold that you remote desktop into your production machines, which adds a new attack vector. So that means that now I know you have ports open for RDP.
Well, what are you going to do? I mean, people are going to attack you with whatever is available. Our passwords are pretty good.
Well, so that's not the point, right? That's like saying the lock on my door is pretty good, but, you know, the most secure house is one without doors.
Right.
And even more secure if I can't find the house.
Right. Well, like I said, we have an obvious upgrade path, which is to move the database to buy another server from Crystal Tech, that's our host, and you know, shift the database over. That would immediately cut our load in half on that server.
Do you think that that's really that simple? It's half? That half of your CPU is being used by the SQL Server and the other half is being used by the web server?
Yeah, it's pretty much an even split. I mean, we watch Task Manager pretty closely. And assuming the processes have been up for the same length of time, which isn't always true, because the worker process tends to get shut down for various reasons. But when they're up for the same amount of times, it's actually shocking how even the CPU usage actually is between the two at the moment.
Hmm. How far can you take this? I mean, have you done capacity planning, any formal capacity planning?
This is the Stack Overflow team. We don't really do any planning. We just kind of do stuff and then just see what happens.
This is just, I'm such a stodgy old dude, because it's like, you know, when you go to a bank, how many people are signing up for online accounts and how often is it, you know, what's the trend line look like? What's the trend line look going backwards? How will it be exponential, geometric, you know, in 10 years or 5 years or even 6 months? What's capacity like? So you're just going to buy hardware when it starts to get to 60%, and then you'll just figure it out from then.
We've been keeping a really close eye on the database. In other words, watching for queries that start to become painful using the profiler. We love the profiler, by the way. It's like my new best friend.
Are you profiling the database in production?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I attach to database all the time and just look at the queries and just see what's going through and what's slow.
And are you concerned about database fragmentation? Do you do anything like that? Have you figured out if your tables break on a page boundary, or do you think about that kind of stuff?
Not currently. I mean, most of the thinking I do is around this query takes 200 milliseconds and it needs to take 50. So then I just break it apart in the query analyzer and try to figure out how to make it faster.
What are some of your biggest tables? Millions? What's your biggest?
Jared, do you want to talk a little bit about, because Jared did a lot of research initially looking at how Wikipedia stores data, and Jared came up with really the initial design. It's been pretty solid. There's been some tweaks, but Jared, did you want to talk about that?
I guess our largest table will be where we store the actual text, you know, of every revision that goes in. You know, as Jeff said, that Stack Overflow does have elements of a wiki so that you can edit any question or, you know, revise its tags. So that, I'd say it's not in the millions of records, definitely not yet, but I think we have, you know, like 300,000-400,000 records right now in our revisions table.
Do you know the state of the fragmentation of the SQL Server database?
No.
No, I mean disk fragmentation. I'm talking about like what's going on in the internal data structures of SQL Server.
Right. No, we have not looked at that yet.
Huh. How many tables are there?
Off the top of my head, I'm not at my computer. I guess we have maybe like 15, 16 tables. I mean, it's not a large schema by any means.
Huh. So a lot of the stuff, I mean, there's little tiny database updates that happen when you vote something up or you get a badge or whatever. This is all just, you know, interlocked increment type stuff. You just plus one all these different little values.
Little updates. Okay, for instance, with voting, like we actually do store a record of every vote that happens, you know, who it happens to, when it happened, so that we can recreate, like for any given user, their reputation. We can actually, you know, have a path of, you know, everything that happened to get that user that score. So we, in certain cases, we do have just straight increments, but most of the increments are all sort of like a denormalized field. We can always get back, you know, and calculate how that value happened.
Now you say get back. Are you saying that you calculate and store?
Yeah, we just think like for a vote. Like if somebody, you know, upvoted somebody's post, we would store a record in the vote table, like this person upmodded a given user's post. And then we would increment their score their reputation on like their user account. On that record, just so we have sort of we don't have to calculate that reputation score every single time, you know, a user gets loaded.
Okay, so you calculate it and score. You calculate it and store
right.
it. But you're saying that if you decided to zero out the reputation column, you could get it all back.
Exactly.
Okay. And do you think that, do you have any sense of how big this will get before, and what will break first? Will it be SQL Server? Will it be the memory on the SQL Server? Will it be your cache? Does your cache try to cache everything? Or if you had 10 times more content and 10 times more traffic, would your cache have to be tuned to cache less?
Yes, we definitely need more memory. Like our server's running, you know, pretty much, Jeff, what's it running at right now?
We still have some disk cache left. It's not actually that overloaded at the moment. But I think it's going to follow a very traditional scaling vector. I think moving the database to its own server, due to the vagaries of how our host works, it's actually cheaper to buy a second server than it is to upgrade memory in the first one. So that effectively doubles our memory space, right? Because then the database is on its own server with 4 gigabytes of memory. The web server has 4 gigabytes of memory. And I got to tell you, Scott, we are abusing HTTP, the cache, the ASP.NET HTTP cache. We're using the heck out of that thing, man. I gotta tell you, it's like my...
Now, are you using kernel caching, or are you just using system.web.cache?
Well, we're using really a mixture. Where we can, we're using sort of the attribute-level output caching. But the trick there is every one of our pages has the user at the top. So doing a whole page cache only really works well for us if you're anonymous, in which case you're not logged in, meaning the page is identical for you and every other anonymous user.
I see.
Yeah,
so when you say HTTP caching, you're talking about like e-tags and client-side caching.
Well, a little bit, but we're also stuffing stuff into the cache. Like
I'm confused. There's basically three levels of caching, right? There's user mode caching, which is like using the cache in ASP.NET. There's kernel mode caching, which would be like using HTTP.sys to see if you can turn a website page around without even hitting IIS.
Right.
And then there's whatever caching the client does.
Right.
So which are you using and in what way?
So we are exploiting some caching in terms of just having correct, you know, HTTP headers sent, things like that, and compression and things like that. But HTTP, the built-in ASP.NET cache is like our new best friend. And one of my favorite new techniques, it's not even really new or very clever, is we're taking a lot of our HTML fragments that we're rendering, and then we're zipping them, and then putting them in the cache, because we have so much CPU time. Not that zip is a computationally expensive operation anymore, but that sort of increases by 10 the size of your cache, because you're not putting HTML in, you're putting gzipped, you know, binary blob.
Really?
In.
You're using like system.io.compression, yep. And you're just taking how much, like 30K and zipping it?
Yep, we do that because, you know, depending on how many tabs you have on a page, there's sort of this combinatorial explosion of the cache, right? Even for an anonymous user,
right.
There's, say, 3 or 4 tabs per page that the user could go to. That means we don't store one copy of the page, we store 4 copies, right? Depending on which tab you're on for the question, for example. So this way, each one of those tabs is like 1/10 the size it would normally be in the cache. So we can fit a lot more of them in without putting pressure on memory. And we have so much CPU, it's like comical. So...
Now, did you take system.web.cache and wrap it and make a gzip cache that zips and unzips as you go in and out of it, or did you do the zipping on the outside?
I did the zipping on the outside, but that would be an awesome addition to the core .NET stuff. It's zip everything that goes in. Why not? I mean,
are you going to open source any of your stuff? I mean, send me that and I'll make a gzip cache.
Yeah, that would make, I think, a good blog entry.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, I'm familiar with the combinatorics, especially it gets really interesting if you did your stuff in multiple languages. Like one of the biggest and worst and most lame bugs in DOS blog to this day remains that sometimes on some pages where I do output caching, but I forget to add in user language as a combinatoric. Like if a German guy is the first guy to hit that page, then it gets cached in German for everybody, no matter what language they speak.
Right. So that's how many languages are there? Like hundreds?
In the world?
Well, I mean, that your site supports, that your site would actually be localized in.
Oh, probably 26?
26. So every page is times 26, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it gets scary really quickly.
It
That's why the zipping
really
is so awesome, because you can fit literally 10 times as much crap in memory. Yeah.
You know, my initial reaction to that is one of, like, disdain and almost a little bit of nausea. Because it just doesn't feel right.
That means we're doing it right. That's good. That's what I like.
It means it's really clever, though. I don't know. I'm going to be really interested to hear from the listeners what they think about that. I think that, you know, you can get into like micro perf and decide how much CPU that's going to take. But ultimately, CPU is going to get faster than the amount of memory that you could buy. Like you can't buy 10 times more memory without getting into big money.
Right. No, it's so true. And we have just stupid amounts of CPU. It's like, even on day one...
That's pretty cool. Now, is this IIS 7 and 64-bit?
Yeah. Oh, that's true. And our stack, I got to say, I love our stack. I mean, I know I'm a Microsoft developer, so it's sort of incestuous for me to even say it, but our stack is really kicking ass because we're 64-bit top to bottom, 64-bit operating system, 64-bit .NET framework, 64-bit SQL Server. And the performance, really, as long as you don't make queries that suck, this is where it gets in. It's just amazing how quickly you can construct a query that just sucks, that just joins the wrong things and takes 300 to 400 milliseconds to come back. As long as you're careful in your query construction, it's amazing how fast things are performing. Like, and we haven't really had to do that much tuning. Mostly it's just been tweaking and paying attention to, you know, the things that are starting to get slow around the edges were places where we had done stupid things. Right, where we didn't have the right index, where our query was really poorly constructed and things like that. So largely we've just been removing those barriers that we put in the system to unlock the performance that was already there. And it's really gratifying to me that a lot of people from the community come in and say, oh, wow, .NET really can be fast, which you and I have known for years. I mean, .NET is really, really fast. It's just a question of, you know, how you use it. And Stack Overflow is a way to show that off as well. And that's why I'm excited to speak with Phil at PDC about MVC and talk about how much we like MVC and how much we really love our stack. Mm-hmm. We're not religious about it, but we're proud of it, right?
Are you going to start blogging like how-tos? Like you've got this, you know, one of the things that that I like about my blog, especially a couple of years ago when I was actively developing, was all of the war stories. You've got a huge pool of war stories and code samples just sitting in your heads now as a collective. Are you going to start getting those best practices out into the world?
Well, some of our stuff isn't actually best practices. Some of our stuff is a little bit scary.
Some of your stuff is probably horrific and should never see the light of day, but still,
right. It
works.
Yeah, no, we've learned a lot, particularly around security. I've done a couple security-related entries. I'll tell you, build a program or website, and you will learn more about security than you ever wanted to know, like, within the first month. I know that was true for us. There were a lot of exploits that we didn't fully understand, and now I think we fully understand them. We definitely have a better understanding of them. And before we get too much deeper, I wanted Jeff Dalgas to talk a little bit about, we've been using cruisecontrol.net, and one of the things that has made this really a pleasure to work on is that we have, you know, continuous integration. Like, we can do builds all the time, right? And we deploy new versions of the site literally every day to the web server, sometimes multiple times. So it's very much rapid development in the sense that, you know, we roll things out sort of as soon as we develop them, and then we get feedback immediately. So, Jeff, did you want to talk a little bit about setting up cruise control and your experience with that?
Sure, yeah. Well, Jeff said a lot there already, but pretty much we have an every check-in build process where one of us checks in, and we all get an email. Well, a build performs, and then the unit tests are run against that build, and we all get an email whether that was successful or not, and we kind of get to watch each other's work as it's checked in and watch the site kind of evolve and basically check ourselves, you know, whether we're putting in good work. I know Jeff's watching us pretty closely.
Well, so we're all watching each other, I would say.
Are you saying that cruise control and continuous integration are really Jeff's opportunity to oppress you?
Yeah, right, pretty much.
if you need to be rescued, we can put together a team and get you out of there.
Right.
Yeah. So another thing, Scott, that'll scare you and make you sad and depressed about our project, and probably justifiably so, our development website is on the same server as production. Do you like that?
Oh, sweet Lord. I thought that you were supposed to be the embodiment of best practices, Jeff. You are.
We're the embodiment of
work
practices. See, just don't do what we do, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to tell people. It's just economics. I mean, we don't really want to buy a lot of servers until we really, really need them. I agree. I don't really like having our development website on the same server, but I guess I'm cheap at the moment because we're kind of in startup mode. Eventually, we will have more than one server, and we will do this the right way. I do see that.
Wow. I don't even know what to say. I'm stupider for having heard this information.
Yeah. Well, when you work with Jeff, you realize that he's at times a little bit of a renegade, but that kind of what makes him a little bit more elite.
Is he a maverick?
Jeff Outwit. You're like, is that really going to work, you think? And then you get in there like, wow, okay, yeah, actually, a lot of homework done here. It actually works.
Well, what
Amazing.
Can people learn from this? I mean, you guys pulled this off in just months,
right?
I mean, their projects are failing left and right.
Yeah.
You've either discovered a new crazy fast and loose caffeine powered way to do software, or you're headed for a huge brick wall.
Well, the way I look at this is there's so many projects out there that you have basically, and not to say anything negative about PHP developers, I don't know how many I would be offending in this particular audience, but there's so many programmers that are just literally just throwing crap out there on the web and just seeing what sticks. I mean, if you look at like Friendster,
just like you did,
and you look at all these really classic websites, I mean, these are not really well-architected things. They just kind of grew into what they were, right? It doesn't actually take, you know, a really good architecture to succeed. It takes, you know, an idea that you just execute on over time, and you keep building it up. And I think that's the more important factor than getting everything right, is just having it be right enough for today, and then having a commitment to improving it every day.
Wow. Well, I think that's probably a good place to stop, because that gives a lot of people a lot of things to think about. Thanks, guys, very much for sitting down with me today. And folks can check it out at stackoverflow.com. And you're going to continue blogging, I hope, maybe a little more often than you have been, Jeff, at codinghorror.com?
Yes, I'm coming back.
You're coming back. Fantastic. All right, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.